Welcome to Everyday Sublime. This is your host, Josh Summers, and it's always a great pleasure to have you here, and I really appreciate your attention. This podcast is my attempt to offer reflections and practice themes and conversations with relevant experts on what I loosely am calling a full-spectrum spirituality, which includes the waking up aspects of spirituality, the growing up, and the cleaning up. It's a low-key, integrally informed vision of practice. And in this particular talk, I just share some reflections, or I should say some seasonal reflections about winter, what dynamics that winter offers and embodies that can resonate within our own spiritual life. And I try to contextualize those dynamics within my own family of origin, and particularly the grappling my family is going through with my eldest niece's cancer. So it gets heavy in this talk, but I enjoyed delivering it live to the Sangha, and we had a really great discussion about it afterwards. So to that note, this podcast is a free podcast, and it is supported by the members of the Riverbird Sangha. This is an online community of people that enjoy practicing yin yoga, yin and yang yoga, qigong, and meditation. You don't have to like all of those practices, but if you like one or two or three of them, we offer, Terry and I, my partner, we offer a pretty unique way of integrating all of these practices together in, again, a kind of low-key integral life practice. If that's of interest to you, do check out the link in the show notes for the Sangha, where you can check out what it's like to practice with us online, look into the details of it more. We give you 2 free weeks of practice with us. That's 2 weeks of live classes with us over Zoom, as well as complete access to all of our recorded classes, workshops, and tutorials in the library. So there's a lot of resources in the library of the Sangha, and we continually hear from people availing themselves of those resources and using them for their own practice, and many teachers who use our practices for their own teaching. And as we say offline, or I should say when we say in our conversations with each other, we describe the Sangha as a kind of guild of yin yoga teachers in general, bringing themes of yin yoga, qigong, and meditation together. And I also include a link in the show notes for the recent workshop where Terry and I offer an extended 2.5-hour deep practice of our core practices. That includes yin yoga by me, yin and yang yoga with Terry, qigong with Terry, and a deep meditative relaxation with some acupressure delivered by me. We felt after this workshop it was probably the best workshop we've ever taught. We're really jazzed about the direction of our own integrative practice now, and we're going to have a lot more to share about that in the year 2024 to come. But if you want a preview of it, if you want to get a taste of that practice that is really nourishing for the spine, both in terms of mobility and fluid strength, do check it out. It's the Winter's Essence practice in the show notes. Again, consider joining the Sangha if you're interested in practicing with us. And I'm looking outside the window right now at a beautiful covering of snow. I'm sending you my best from Maine, and I hope you enjoy today's talk, Winter's Essence. Okay, everybody, welcome to our Monday Dharma Sangha session. In which we'll have a little bit of Dharma meditative spiritual reflection, some time to sit quietly together in meditation, and then on the other side of that, all that time to connect and discuss and really get into what's alive in your practice and what we can all learn from each other. The 4th of December. And as I looked out the window today, when the sun began to come up, I could see that overnight in Maine and probably other parts of New England, we received snowfall, a few inches here. And this really marks the first snowfall of the season. And whenever I see the first snowfall, my spiritual mind, I should say, always returns to a talk that I heard years ago by the English monk and abbot of Amaravati Monastery, whose name is Ajahn Amaro. And Amaro described in this talk how after a snowstorm, or after during a snowstorm even, one can become palpably aware of how quiet the environment becomes. And in that quietude, there's a very dramatic change in our visual field, that every surface is suddenly covered by this dusting of white beauty. And so we're looking at we're looking at the same thing, but by virtue of there being snow on it, we see the normal, we see the everyday with entirely different eyes. And there's something, for me, very arresting and beautiful about that. But Amaro's point was that just like snowfall can change the way we see the ordinary, we look at the natural world with a different perspective and maybe a different appreciation or sensibility. Amaro compared that to the change in perception that comes when the heart realizes that everything, without exception, is impermanent. That everything, in a sense, has that dusting of a characteristic, that everything that we experience is going to be and is impermanent. And of course, to the conditioned sense of self, primarily the sense of self that likes things the way it wants things, impermanence feels like a real bitter dose of bad news. And for centuries, and at least a few thousand years since the Buddha was teaching, probably long before he came on the scene, mystics have taken the opposite perspective, that it's through a full embrace of impermanence, a cultivation that confronts impermanence, that steps out of denying it, that in that process, in that gesture of embracing it, a very, very different view of life, a very, very different experience of what it means to be alive can awaken, can explode out of one's being. And so, you know, we got this beautiful dusting of snow overnight, and that reflection from Amaro always comes back. And it feels timely to me in many ways, but most specifically and poignantly, and it feels timely in relationship to the conditions in my family, particularly as they center around the health of my niece who's working or struggling or battling, whatever cliche verb comes to mind. My niece who's living with cancer. And her status is pretty stable at the moment, it seems. She's getting her second round of radiation, and she's being tapered on the steroids that she was taking. And I can't remember if I've shared this, but one of the consequences of the steroids, which if you've known anybody that's ever taken steroids for significant amounts of time, is that they can swell up and blow up, become very puffy. And the physical form can really become quite different. The word unrecognizable has been used by myself, my sister, and father. And just seeing that transformation of her body is a difficult teaching on impermanence. And then over the weekend, just yesterday, my niece's mother, my youngest sister, sent two photographs over texting. And the two photographs showed my niece and my sister with new haircuts. And both of them had shaved their head. And the little information I received about this was that the radiation was really causing my niece's hair to fall out. And so rather than trying to patch things up and braid things in a particular way, my sister just decided to go in it with my niece and shave. And they're beautiful photographs. My sister and niece are both smiling. And the smile is one of those smiles that really feels like it conveys the something deep and profound about someone's spirit. The spirit seems to be very, very bright in these photos. And the one other line that my sister sent was, "I'm beginning to look more like Josh." And that, you know, when you don't get a lot of you don't get a lot of information coming through, sometimes you wonder how are they doing with this, and what does this mean for them, and how are they holding it? And to get that line, "I'm beginning to look more like Josh," with its levity, its lightness, its humor, its sibling dig, if you will. That felt good to know that my own follicle challenges may have softened and maybe paved the way for some ease with that transformation and change. And so that those images came in the morning, and at one point I had to go to a neighboring town, Brunswick, to do some errands midday. And as these things go, there was sort of a little bit of texting going on between me and my dad, me and my other sister, me and my mother, and we were all speaking about the impact that seeing those photos had on us. And my mother was audibly, when I spoke to her, very, very sad and having a hard time. And my dad, who's characteristically quite quite verbose, you know, my dad is not short-winded when it comes to speaking, but my dad was uncharacteristically quiet. He just said, "Yes, I saw the photos." And I texted back to him. I said, "They're in one breath, they are both extraordinarily beautiful and excruciating." And he wrote back, he said, "Could you please say more about that duality? The duality between beauty and excruciating pain." And I thought about it for a little bit. I said, let me get back to you. I'm moving wood and I'm doing a few errands right now, but let me come back to you. So as I continued to do my chores, I was reflecting on what is the relationship between something that on the face of it can seem so horrible and the beauty that I saw simultaneously in these photos. And after I gathered a few of my thoughts around this, I sat down and I typed out a text to my dad and I said, you know, somehow in seeing both my niece and my sister with shaved heads, there's a way that I feel like I can step back and even look at the whole situation as an outsider might. And I use the example, I said, if I were at a museum exhibition and a photographer was featuring these photos, and if I were to stand and look at the photo or any of these photos, what do I see? So stripped of all personal relationship to it, my own personal relationship, what would I see? And I shared that I saw a mother and a daughter fully embracing mortality. Elsewhere, my dad had used the phrase that my sister was taking a full frontal embrace of what's happening. And so I saw that too, that this is a full frontal embrace of mortality. And in that unflinching embrace, I see a kind of eternal love released. A love that transcends time, health, hair. And something my other sister pointed out too, which I felt and noticed, was that in the photograph, my sister and niece were both in their pajamas of some sort. But there was something about the pajamas that looked a little bit like robes, a little bit like monastic garb, monastic clothing. And between that and the shaved heads, my sister commented, they look like Buddhists. They look like Buddhists. They look like Buddhist monastics. And I agreed. I thought, yeah, they really do. And that itself got me thinking more about the heart direction of a Buddhist path, whether we're lay practitioners or monastics, and my own attraction to that path. You know, if I think about it, there are lots of spiritual paths out there, and for whatever reason, the Buddhist path in particular really spoke to me. It spoke to me many years ago, and the more I thought about it, I began to wonder, was there something about the shaved head that was welcoming? And the answer kept coming back, of course. Of course the shaved head was welcoming. Because at 18 years old, my own hair started to depart this world. And at the time, it was not a welcomed arrival, that change of circumstances. I was early in college, and with thinning hair at that age, I felt incredibly socially self-conscious. And by the time I graduated from college, I had earned amongst my friends an all-star title. In that my friends had identified certain all-stars on campus that stood out. One was there was a guy who seemed to run wherever he went on campus, and his nickname was appropriately Forrest Gump. He was the guy that was always running everywhere. So there was Forrest Gump as one of the all-stars, and I was given the title of grad student.
or assistant professor. I looked like the grad student in the undergraduate class. You know, at the time I was really upset about losing hair, and I just remembered this morning that friends at the time, these are the kinds of friends I keep. This is way before Google-driven ads and Google-driven suggestions. But in the pre-internet age of being at university, I would often find in my mailbox advertisements for hair growth products that had been anonymously dropped there by well-meaning friends. But it was actually only a few years ago that I heard a philosopher, who I mention every now and then, Ken Wilber, speaking about hair loss and the trauma that many people experience when they lose their hair. And he quoted something about men with cancer find losing their hair more traumatizing than the chemotherapy. It's quite something. But I think for me, you know, having a club to be a part of where baldness was an indicator or a mark of participation felt very welcoming and comforting to me, even though, you know, many lay Buddhists don't necessarily shave their head. There's nothing about being Buddhist that demands that. But when I've been around monks and nuns and people who have really devoted their life completely to this path, there is something liberating about someone who directly confronts their mortality. And there's a as I was seeing in my sister and niece, a spirit that is released in that confrontation. So I think as I've been reflecting on this, and part of my reflection involves journaling and communicating with family members, a slightly different way of speaking about the what is attributed to be the Buddha's core teachings has come to me, or has sort of resurfaced. It's not mine per se, but it's a way of thinking about what are referred to as the Four Noble Truths. And this is a larger conversation, but just the phrase itself, Four Noble Truths, often implies that there's these four truths that you have to either come to understand, or four truths that you have to agree with or subscribe to, or you know, relate to in a way that there's sort of some sort of agreement. And largely inspired by another English teacher named Stephen Batchelor, I think of these teachings as activities to collaborate or participate with. And so the first truth is often articulated as something as there is dukkha, there is suffering. And if I were to massage that a little bit, instead of making it a statement that you have to agree with or believe or recognize, and put it into terms of an activity, we might say something like, the First Noble Truth suggests that we're no longer denying pain. It's the activity of no longer denying mortality, or no longer denying the way it is in our experience. And the second truth is often articulated as the origin of suffering, the reason why we suffer, and usually is defined as some sort of self-centered grasping, self-referential grasping, grasping at an idea of self, a habit of self. But I want to suggest, just this morning reflection, that when we step out of the denial of pain, when we stop denying pain, the universality of pain, we can also let go of our habits of denial. Because denying is a multifactorial, multifaceted kind of behavior. It involves behaviors of attention, behaviors of relationship, behaviors of consumption, behaviors of speech. And I think it's an interesting question. What is it just to hold in one's practice? What does it mean to let go of habits of denial? And the third, just go through these briefly, the third reflection, the third teaching, the third truth is often presented as the what happens, what one realizes when one stops grasping habitually at things. It tends to refer to this third teaching refers to what one realizes when grasping is released. Namely, one starts to intuit a peace, a well-being, a sanity of existence that is not dependent on anything, that's independent of circumstance, that there's a radical peace available to each and every one of us. And one way I might try to suggest that we can acknowledge or know that peace ourselves is through the doorway of awareness. And in some ways, I see this third noble truth of the Buddha as a celebration for awareness itself. The fact that it's something to, that there's something that it's like to be you. The fact that that is rather than not. When you think about all the other ways that life could have gone and has gone, to be able to be grateful at the core that you're conscious at all rather than not. That's a special kind of gratitude, I think. Because any looking around, and if you're paying attention a little bit, you realize the conditions that come together to support being conscious. You could say in all life forms, it's rare, at least the way it seems, and I'm not getting into the way it actually, like philosophically is, but just the way it seems, is that being grateful for the experience of consciousness doesn't seem to be a common gratitude. But it is this very rare and precious thing, extremely rare and precious. And as an outflow of being conscious and knowing that you're conscious and having gratitude for that, the fourth noble truth is often defined as a path of integration. How do we act how do we live in a way that mitigates and does not habitually reenact patterns of suffering? How do we live and act? And so the way I might reflect on the fourth noble truth is that action is a question of compassion. When we and they all go together, all these reflections, when we stop denying the pain of life, we stop denying our mortality, we stop the habits, we learn to let go of the habits of denying. And it really hits us, the rarity of consciousness itself and our extreme, this may be triggering for some, but the extreme good fortune that we're conscious at all. And then in becoming in a sense more sensitized to dynamics of relationship, dynamics of existence, looking out from this view, I see, and I think many people see and have seen, that they're looking out from this view of denying our mortality, being lost in habits of denial. Looking from this view, the world can really look like a pageantry, a very tragic pageantry of unnecessary suffering. And I think what the Buddhists are really getting at is when you see that, when you get that, becomes clearer, your own motivation for how you want to live, how you want to be, how you want to help others starts to change. There's a one of the Sangha members, Mary, had sent me a book last year on centering prayer, which is a contemplative practice in contemplative Christianity. And the author of this book was just a wonderful spiritual writer named Cynthia Borgo. Said all traditions, all wisdom traditions, East and West, seem to boil down to three interrelated dynamics. There's the dynamic of surrender. And that's a question, what are we asked to surrender in practice? There's the dynamic of attention. And there's the dynamic or activity of compassion. And if I were to take those three, surrender, attention, and compassion, I hope you might see that that's what I've been trying to speak about. Surrendering our denial. Surrendering the habits of denial. Surrendering to an appreciation and gratitude for consciousness. That there is that which is awake. And even a surrender to compassion. And these are, I feel like I'm just scratching the surface of all of this, you know, coming around again on some central themes, but just putting things on the map again, or pointing them out. And I had shared a question in the newsletter yesterday about in training, my question was, in training and shaping the heart, what do you see as essential elements? And I spoke about consistency of practice and sincerity of practice and creativity of practice and safety of practice and community and Sangha, all being important elements of shaping the heart. And some of the responses I receive, which were wonderful, and thank you for those that have written back, keep them coming. But others added qualities or elements of forgiveness. Forgiveness being a central theme of shaping the heart. Patience. Sincerity and authenticity. Authenticity to oneself. And awareness was also mentioned. A discipline of awareness. So I'm going to bring us into a meditation now. And just before I start the meditation, I want to read a quotation that I was thinking of using for the workshop over the weekend. And this is a quotation that this Christian teacher, Cynthia Brogo, quoted from in her book on the heart of centering prayer. "Don't let the word Christian fool you. What is the wisdom that's contained in this quotation could be Buddhist, could be Taoist, could be Muslim, it could be Jewish, it could be any of the deep mystical wisdom that the earth has celebrated. I want to read it now, and then so when you're up and conscious, I want you just to read it now. And then when we settle into the meditation, I'll just read it again more slowly and let this quotation be the prompt for our practice today. And as you listen, I just want to listen for how this might resonate with what I was trying to reflect on, these themes of surrender, attention, compassion. This is Beatrice Bruteau, who wrote, "The task, clearly, is to detach the sense of identity from the descriptions of yourself. This does not mean to find another description of you that would be the correct one. It means to realize that there is no description of you, that which is called by your name, your body, your history, your personality, your feelings. None of that is ultimately you. Whatever is capable of being described and distinguished from other descriptions, all of that is to be stripped off so that the remaining selfhood may be called naked, as it often is in the mystical traditions." So that quote is a nod also to the talk from last week about fallen leaves, the leaves that fall off trees. Metaphorically representing the shedding of limited identity so that the remaining selfhood can be known.
Okay, everyone, thanks for your attention today. And once again, if you would like support in your own practice, if you'd like to support the podcast and also support your practice, please consider joining the Riverbird Sangha, where we are a community of one practice, many forms, the practice of waking up the heart and mind with creativity, improvisation, weaving the practices of yin yoga, yang yoga, qigong, and contemplative meditation, primarily informed by Buddhism. But if that's of interest to you, you might also sample our practice by picking up a copy of our recent workshop. We're offering the replay now, where you can have our extended 2.5-hour practice, which we really recommend you do at least once a week for yourself. Give yourself the kind of a spa-like luxury of deep extended practice. It's so important to do in general, but it's particularly important to do it in the winter. So that we offered that workshop early in the season with the hope that people would be able to avail themselves of the workshop and the ability to practice along with the workshop again and again through the winter. And we really hope it supports you through the season. I guess supports you through the season if you're in the Northern Hemisphere like us. If you're in the Southern Hemisphere, we're going to get our hemisphere coordination going for the new year, so stay tuned. But before I sign off, I just want to say there's clearly, the world's just aflame in a way that I can barely get my head around. And wherever you are, however you are, we send our best to you from Maine. And let's keep our practice strong. So stay strong, keep practicing, and I look forward to seeing the next episode. All my best.